Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The use of fees are ubiquitous today. Buy tickets to a concert, expect to pay another 10 to 20% more in ticket fees. Buy something online, expect to pay about double the actual shipping costs. Have an interaction with government, well, expect to pay fees there as well. My guest today writes about the system of fees in use in some of the most elemental and fundamental ways Americans build wealth. Mortgages, banking, student loans, and auto insurance. The areas of home ownership, savings, education, and reliable transportation have long been considered the building blocks to building wealth. And Professor Devin Fergus says the system of fees in these areas have steadily grown with the rollback of America's financial regulatory infrastructure, which has resulted in nothing less than a system of wealth redistribution from the middle class and the poor to wealthy corporations. What began as a way to recoup costs are now a healthy profit center. His book, Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the Middle Class, relates the history of the financial regulatory rollback in these areas, a history that goes back 40, 50 years that have benefited the money class and hurt consumers. Dr. Devin Fergus is the Strickland Distinguished Professor of History, Black Studies, and Public Affairs at the University of Missouri, and the first historian named to the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative. He serves as a policy expert for the Aspen Institute and the Center for Global Policy Solutions, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Devin Fergus, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, when I first picked up your book, I really expected it to be about the system of fees that businesses and government increasingly have been using over the last decade or two to disguise price increases and tax increases. But the fees you focus on are more fundamental to the economy. Can you talk a little bit about the cumulative effect of these fees?
Sure. So the cumulative effect in the fees that I sort of lay out in the book is over $1 trillion almost annually for American consumers. And those fees come in the form of fees in terms of mortgages, fees in terms of student loans, fees also in terms of employment. I look at fees via employment through things like payday lending, which is the private sector's efforts to sort of address the issues of wage stagnation. And then finally, what connects us to home, school, and work, those three parts. Fees in terms of transportation, specifically fees related to auto insurance. And so those fees, with some others, sort of, as I mentioned, sort of amount to over $1 trillion of fees annually. Your point about public fines and fees is extremely sort of well taken, frankly, though. And I would be happy to sort of talk about that a little bit initially, if you like to.
Well, if government has now used a system of fees, you know, when you look at the court system, whether you're in criminal court or civil court, those courts are not financed by the state, but by the users and the people who are being charged in criminal court.
Excellent point. And this happens in almost in many states across the U.S., whether it's in North Carolina, in California. Illinois is one of the prime examples of the rise of public government fees. And these fees actually are ways, as you mentioned before, to generate revenue. I mean, I'm not sure how old you are. Richie sounds like a very young man, but I'm old enough to actually remember George H.W. Bush when he ran for election in the early 1990s. He talked about no new taxes, frankly. And then he ended up sort of, taxes ended up being increased under the George H.W. Bush administration. And he was sort of pilloried publicly, politically, for raising taxes. So no politician wants to be accused of raising someone's taxes. And so the backdoor way in which government generates revenue is, as you mentioned before, is through the rise of public fines and fees. And we all understand that government needs money to cover expenses and costs. And so from 1970 through the really almost 2015, 2016, all new government revenue was primarily generated, not from taxes, but primarily through things like fines and fees. And so the private sector sort of mirrors the rise of public fines and fees. So I'm very happy that you actually introduced that, because these things are two sides almost of the same coin.
And they're very much interrelated, because when you look at the charges associated with mortgages, banking, auto insurance rates, student loans, and payday lending, which are the areas you cover in the book, not only are these fundamental elements of building wealth and assets, a lot of times the fees associated with them were put in place in the same ways that fees were put in on government services, the idea that if you utilize the services, you should pay for them. And that was sort of how these fees were introduced in all of these areas.
No, absolutely right. And so the National Economic Council in late December 2016 put out a report indicating that the growing trend of fees on the U.S. economy, as you sort of referenced, as a way to, in having the impact of systematically sort of transferring wealth from consumers and primarily members of the middle class and working populations to large-scale investors and companies and corporations. And so for the fees that the private fees that this government report focuses on in December 2016 are primarily fees associated with things like hotel resort fees, hotel fees or cell phone fees or utility fees. But as you mentioned, my research focuses on fees which are having escalated in areas which are central and key to upward mobility in our free market private property economy, housing. And as we all know, that housing is a key to generating wealth in private property economy. Education, we talk about education as this passport to upward mobility in the U.S. And then, as I mentioned before, employment. Employment is key for upward mobility and status in the middle class. And then what connects us to home, school, and work, as I mentioned before, fees and auto insurance. And so in these major conveyances of mobility, not surprisingly, the private market has stepped in with escalating fees and costs that are almost impossible to sort of sift out of.
One of the things that comes out is that unlike the fees that government or businesses do to offset the cost of, you know, administrative fees, in most of these cases, these fees on mortgages, banking, auto insurance rates, student loans, they have become an important source of income for the lenders who are doing this. It has become as big as perhaps as the interest that there are being paid on those instruments. And that you sort of outlined some efforts to go through the court system to look at fees as a penalty and the true administrative costs, and courts have basically said, no, this is pretty much like interest.
No, absolutely right. And it's kind of a shell game that many of these creditors and lenders play. But when it's to their advantage, they claim that this is not interest. And interest, it's important to understand why it's defined as interest. Interest often falls under the legal rubric of usury. And with usury, there are sort of interest rates or usury sort of caps. And so if it's defined as interest in many ways, then often it comes under some kind of sort of greater regulatory scrutiny. And so creditors, particularly payday lending industry, sort of classic example, they want to have these fees legally defined not as interest or interest rates, but as fees, because interest rates often trigger greater regulatory scrutiny than having something defined as a fee or surcharge or extra cost. And so, payday lenders are the classic example of how industry wants to have it sort of both ways and want to define it not as interest, but as a fee or extra cost when it thinks it can escape sort of regulatory oversight and regulatory sort of policing. When these fees sort of function often like interest, as they fees often function like a tax in terms of they transfer wealth.
Right. And of course, when it does benefit them to call it a fee, they call it a fee because, you know, they can charge. Yes. There's no function to whatever the principal was associated with the cost.
Great point, Rich. Yeah, so if it's interest, there's often an interest rate cap that states often have, frankly. But if it's defined as a fee, there's rarely a cap on it of fees. And, of course, have sometimes ruled differently, but generally speaking, they're rarely caps on fees. And so lenders, payday lenders specifically, often are focused on having these things described as fees or surcharges or add-on costs and not as interest, because interest rates, again, often are capped, have greater regulatory scrutiny, which means, they're interest rate caps. And they're trying to avoid these caps so they can charge as much as they want. And then there are examples where payday loans, the fees associated with payday loans are actually higher than the actual principals themselves.
Wow.
And so, yeah, the fees are profit-generating in and of themselves. And you mentioned before about, used to be that these used to cover administrative costs. That's a very old way of thinking about fees. Fees are now designed to generate profit and income for the private sector and revenue for the public sector.
Mm. One of the things you talked about is how difficult it is to sort of sift out how fees engage with the act of borrowing money or insurance rates and all that. And you said, you know, it's like the side of a box of cake mix. It's almost impossible to sift out what is the cost of the loan and what is these fees. And a lot of times they're fairly small fees. But you said it really adds up over, you know, the course of, here's list them, say, as origination fees for student loans, title search fees for mortgages, percentage or flat rate fees tacked onto the principal of a payday loan, tuition and fees at a university. It could be as little as 5% or 1% of the loan, but you're looking at billions and billions of dollars.
No, again, great point. Let's go back to that example about tuition and fees as a concrete example of the impossibility to sift out a fee. So again, you can be listed, fee can be listed, but you still have to sort of pay that cost. And so universities, higher education has sort of talked about trying to keep tuition low. But often the dirty little secret is while they're able to keep tuition sort of low, they increase user fees. And without paying the fee, a registration fee, for instance, a student at the University of Missouri or University of Tulsa or Oklahoma University, a student is unable to actually officially and legally sort of register for my class or at a university class. So yeah, you can claim to keep tuition low, but if the student doesn't pay that fee, they're unable to sort of sit in class. And that's an example of, yes, the fee might be itemized, but it's impossible to sort of sift it out. And you also referenced auto insurance. And auto insurance is an example of not simply a fee that exists that's impossible to sort of sift out, but often a hidden fee in auto insurance. And that hidden fee comes in the form of something called the territory rating system fee.
Yes. So I think you also refer to it as postal code profiling.
Precisely. Yes. Yes. Postal code or PC for postal code profiling. So we live in an age now, it's not necessarily politically correct to profile people by gender or by race or by age. I think about the 2008 election where all of those categories sort of come into play with Barack Obama and his race, Sarah Palin, her gender, John McCain, his age. These issues, again, people aren't politically incorrect to profile people by those things, but it's still quite perceived to be okay to profile people by postal code. And we see this PC profiling, postal code profiling, manifest itself mostly in things like auto insurance, where auto insurance rates are predicated almost as much by where one lives as much as how one drives. You know, and for me, for my research, this is a key question in a society that's predicated upon the Western concept and notion of individual merit. And so the individual merit of a motorist can be very easily defined as how does this motorist get into car accidents? Does this motorist have moving violations? How far does this motorist drive in their vehicle? We all know that the length of how much drives is a factor of one likely to get into accidents or to get a moving violation. So these are the individual merits of a motorist. Yet still, they often take a back seat to things like the social environment, i.e. postal code or zip code. And so zip code can add as much to $300 or $400 or $500 annually to one's auto insurance rates, just simply by where one lives.
And I was struck by something you wrote, which is that it's almost impossible for a consumer to see the influence of where they live on their automobile insurance rates.
Yes, no, precisely right. It's proprietary information, the insurance industry has sort of argued, so it's almost literally impossible to kind of sort of figure out what percentage it's been, it affects one's rates. And so the insurance industry has sort of jealously guarded the actual calculus that's involved, but there are ways to kind of get a rough estimate of what that amount might be, and it's not simply. I'd say this too, Rich. It's not simply postal code. That's a major factor and probably the primary social environment determinant. But there are also other factors that are unrelated to individual merit of the motorist. And here I'm talking about college education or college degree. So on the back of my alumni magazine, frequently or to get in the mail, on the back of the alumni magazine, it says, because I'm a graduate of a particular institution, I can get a reduced auto insurance rate. Now, yes, and so because I have a college degree doesn't mean I'm a good driver, right? And so these things aren't necessarily related, but there's certain advantages that's provided because of social environment that are untethered from issues of the individual merit of a motorist, how one actually drives.
My guest today is Devin Fergus. He's the Strickland Distinguished Professor of History, Black Studies, and Public Affairs at the University of Missouri. He's also a policy expert for the Aspen Institute and the author of Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class, published by Oxford University Press. And in this book, he sort of relates this idea of all the hidden costs of fees that are apparent in virtually everything we buy in which there is a user agreement or a contract, which, you know, most of us don't read, and the fees of how those fees transfer from the middle class and the working classes to the upper class to business interests. And he tackles things like mortgages, banking, auto insurance rates, student loans, and payday lending. In each of these areas, you go into a great deal of depth, going back some 40 years in how the growth of fees have impacted each one of these industries. Very interesting reading, but it would take a lot of time to talk about it. So as we talk about things like the growth of subprime mortgages, use of balloon payments, you know, I was thinking, is this still a thing in 2020? And then you sort of allude to things like some of the ads you'll see in the Super Bowl, which you can apply for a mortgage in 8 minutes during halftime, which lets you know that these subprime mortgages are alive and well and are having a great impact.
No, and absolutely right. And this is another angle we can come to the mortgage question issue and the impact of mortgages on individual lives. Because as you I think referenced in the beginning, I look at wealth inequality and the wealth gap. And that wealth gap primarily affects historically marginalized sort of and vulnerable populations, women, for instance, immigrants, sort of young people. And so if you look at, let's say, the first encounter that a consumer has with a major financial investment is actually not the mortgage, but the student loan. What we know with student loans is that you have a student loan and the average borrower owes now over $30,000 a year in terms of this student loan amount. That debt amount, increased debt to income ratio, has a negative impact or correlates negatively reducing one's credit score. And what we know is that with a reduced or lower credit score, you're going to pay more for that mortgage interest. And this is critical because you go into a student loan, for instance, with the ostensible promise from the lender that loan is going to be paid off in 10 years. But if you're going after you get the student loan, you come out of college, you want to go buy a house, that's a 30-year mortgage. Rather than simply a 10-year impact or hit on how much you pay, that cost is folded into the mortgage, which means that, again, that mortgage interest points are higher, your mortgage interest rates, your monthly mortgage payment is higher, and that reduces the amount of wealth for these historically vulnerable populations. Why for historically vulnerable populations? Because they are far more likely to take out a student loan than the majority sort of populations. And so even if you can make the argument that the subprime mortgage industry is not what it once was or used to be, the ways in which these costs get increased for historically vulnerable populations comes through the way often of things like student loans, which again helps to sort of correlate with lower credit scores, increasing the cost of a mortgage loan if you were able to actually get one. And so this is the backdoor way in which wealth gets extracted, even through mortgage lending, even if the subprime industry is not what it once was.
And of course, the student loan industry is huge today. I mean, you're talking well over, I think there was a statistic in the book, it went from somewhere around 50% of people taking out student loans, say 10 to 15 years ago, yeah, to more closer to 75% today.
Precisely, exactly. And 75%, and it's the second largest form of consumer debt behind a mortgage. It surpassed things like credit cards, so we said, had by 2016, 2017. So absolutely, the student loan industry is large, robust, It's not getting any smaller. Their efforts to try to rein it in the 1990s. And what happens, for instance, let's say the 1990s, this is a, sort of a good example of the rise of special interests, of beating back logical and rational ways to address the issue. So the 1990s, for instance, with the student loan industry, they tried to rein in the cost of student loans through something called direct lending of student loans. And direct lending is exactly how it sounds. Government says, we're going to cut out the middleman in the student loan industry. And the middleman was the private sector, which government subsidized. And said, we're going to cut out this the lender, and we're going to loan directly to the borrower, i.e. the student. And evidence, and I said, when I say evidence, I mean evidence from both administrations, both from the George H.W. Bush administration, actually, some late research there, from the Clinton administration, and then from the George W. Bush administration, evidence from these both administrations across parties showed that this direct lending program was a much cheaper loan product and a more efficient loan product for the borrower, or the student. And this is why this is important, because we all know that the cheaper a loan product is, the less likely is that a borrower is going to default. That's just, I mean, common and logical sense.
Right.
The cheaper your car loan is, the less likely you're able to pay it. The same thing with a mortgage loan.
And the default rates were lower, too, as well, correct?
Exactly. And so the default rates were lower. So, but the problem with the direct lending is that it cut out this private sector, the private market. And so the private market, again, concerned about being cut out of the very sort of profitable student lending industry, really begins to sort of pour money and throw money into the coffers of lawmakers and policymakers, who then begin to water down direct lending and basically sort of make it ineffective and reduce the amount of direct loans that are being given out. So direct loans, the projection was that direct loans would be 75, 80 to 90% of all student loans given out by the year 2000. But that number never reached above 36%. And then increasing throughout the 90s, that number got smaller and smaller and smaller. Again, even though we know that it was the cheaper loan product. And this you can say this, well, I didn't go to college, I didn't take out a student loan because I could afford to go to college. How does this affect me? The cheaper a loan product, more likely is the borrower's payback. And we all know that the person that the borrower is paying back is actually the taxpayer. And so the less likely the taxpayer is going to be on the hook for a defaulted loan. And so by not having a direct lending, you increase the likelihood that taxpayers are actually on the hook for default student loans. And then, so this is how, again, the private sector increased risk and increased trouble for not just the borrower, but also for the taxpayer.
You also tackle payday loans and the growth. What's really amazing to me is the growth of payday loans. We've known that for a long time they've been really targeted towards people on the lower socioeconomic ends of the spectrum. But say in the last decade, that growth has gone to people at median income levels and beyond. They're being used in a lot of different ways. I think that some people may be completely ignorant of.
No, that's a wonderful point. Excellent point too. Yes, because definitely the stereotype or working perception is that the payday loan goes to someone who's working poor, or someone who's just poor. But a payday loan is exactly what it sounds like. It's a payday loan. So someone who actually who's gainfully employed, right? And it's also, to take out a payday loan, you need two things. You need a paycheck stub. And secondly, for most of the payday loans, you also need a bank account, because you write a check and that check is drawn upon one's bank account. These, for much of the 20th century, were considered to be barometers and markers of middle class consumption. And now we see that these things that we still associate with being middle class, a steady paycheck, a bank account, are actually criteria and requirements for a payday loan. And so at the point of the economic crisis, there were actually more payday loan stores than Starbucks and McDonald's combined. And again, there are no greater perhaps barometers or models of middle-class consumption than Starbucks. But yeah, still, they're more petty lenders than Starbucks out there.
The name of the book is Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. My guest is Devin Fergus. He is a distinguished professor of history at the University of Missouri and a policy expert for the Aspen Institute. In a book like this, and you acknowledge this in sort of the epilogue, that you would expect a series of policy solutions, but you write that absent some fundamental changes in how government functions and its responsiveness to big donors, policy solutions will do fairly little. Why do you remain so pessimistic today?
Because of, and here I'll bring the historian out of me, it's the lack or loss of political will. And that's the great concern, the lack of loss of political will to address and restore what we call economic democracy. And so we see a similar sort of lack and loss of political will coming out of things like the Civil War. We see the rise of economic political will from lawmakers in the aftermath of the Gilded Age, or in response, I should say, to the Gilded Age or this progressive period where lawmakers have the political will to do things like pass a progressive income tax, for instance, to do more regulatory controls over trade, domestic trade, and monopolization in the U.S., economic concentration. So there are periods of time in U.S. history where we see a rise of political will and a loss of political will. And until you have a greater political will to address these issues, nibbling at the edges, and we could talk about in these various spheres, will do almost little. And for me, the one example we can have in terms of actual policy sort of conversations is the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or the CFPB,
right.
Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which comes out of the Dodd-Frank Act. And the CFPB has actually helped to rein in some of the most predatory and abusive areas of lending, at least attempted to. But now there's efforts, again, to roll back the CFPB, and quite effective efforts, and to mute that age, and quite effective efforts. And that's, again, the CFPB was just one slice of one example of it. So until you have a greater political will to address the rise of money and influence in politics and in policy making, you can try to address these issues, but it's kind of like playing whack-a-mole. You might attack them on the question of interest, they'll just redefine it as a different form of interest or a fee. And so that's why the lack of I'm concerned about the inauspiciousness of this problem moving forward.
And the name of the book is Land of the Fee. Devin Fergus, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, for having me.
Devin Fergus is the Strickland Distinguished Professor of History, Black Studies, and Public Affairs at the University of Missouri and the author of Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. It's published by Oxford University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.